I'm delighted now to welcome to the program David Robleski. He's the author of the best-selling novel and Oprah Book Club pick, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock, and part of the proceeds from the book sales will go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome, David.
Hi, good morning.
It's great to have you. This is, I'm a dog person, so this is an unusual and fascinating novel because some of the characters are dogs, and there is a deep observation of the emotions and motivations of dogs in this book. When you were writing the dog characters, were you trying to make accurate and realistic characterizations of the dogs, or is there a necessary component of imaginative license and even perhaps anthropomorphizing in their characters?
That's a great question. I think that you know animals in general have an experience of the world that is entirely different from ours, because the way we interact with the world is so bound up with our capability for language. We think through words, we experience things through words, and so on. And of course, dogs and other animals don't. So if you're going to render their experience into words at all, you're at some level engaging in some kind of anthropomorphization. And I actually struggled with that a fair amount as I was writing. I resisted writing any of the book from a dog's point of view because I thought that's exactly what I don't want to do. I don't want to have a person in a dog suit in this book. I want a dog as a dog. But in the end, I decided that there were certain compromises that I could make, and I could try and separate the tone and sound of those sections and the sensibility of those sections so that they felt as distinctly non-human as possible.
I think it's such a fascinating read in many regards, because there are things that human beings and animals share, and there are really things that they don't share, and I want to talk more about that in a moment. But what were the inspirations, both literary and real life, that led you to include them in such a profound way? I mean, I couldn't think of, not that I'm so well-read, but I couldn't think of precedents besides Jack London.
Well, first of all, you put your finger on one big precedent. I grew up with a lot of dogs, so in terms of my life experience, when I was a kid, probably from the time I was 4 or 5 years old until I was 10 or 12 years old, my folks raised dogs, and my main job around the farm was to work with the pups, socialize the pups, and so on. And so, that's just part of my early life experience, and I think I imprinted on the experience of being with dogs, viewing them as your equals, your playmates, and so on. But what happened for me was a few years went by after I got out of college. I didn't have a dog. First time in my life I hadn't lived with a dog. When I got a dog finally, she was such a great dog that I had this experience of thinking, I'm not a good enough person to have this dog. I need to be a better dog owner. I need to learn about dogs and dog training more than I prided myself on knowing. And I began a sort of investigation into more modern training techniques than I knew, and all the science behind animal cognition that has come out since then. And all that material sort of got put into the blender I became so interested in that, I wanted to see if there was a way to pose some of that that information in a dramatic framework. So that's at least one source for this book.
The character, Edgar Sawtelle, is born without the ability to speak, but he's normal in every other way. And, of course, he develops deep nonverbal relationships with the dog, particularly the dog Almandine. And I read somewhere that this mute character, Edgar, came from an experience you had when you were young of having had minor surgery, which left you unable to speak for a short time. What about that experience that you had gave rise to this character?
Yeah, I wasn't so young. I was probably around 30.
Okay.
Although now that looks young to me. yeah, what happened, I had very minor oral surgery. I had a stitch in my mouth in a place that made it hard for me to talk intelligibly. So, and I knew it was temporary. I didn't, it wasn't really a problem, but I thought, well, rather than continue to explain this for the next week, I'll just not talk and see how that works. And what I learned from that was that I immediately began to observe the world around me better because I wasn't spending any of my attention trying to figure out what I was going to say or how I was going to engage in conversation. So I noticed the physical world more clearly, and I noticed the social interactions around me more clearly because in some way I wasn't a full participant. And I made a note to myself at the time. I hadn't started working on this book yet, but I was interested in writing a novel of some kind. I knew it was going to involve dogs, and I thought if I could give a character this quality, with lacking the ability to speak, but being in some sense a linguistic prodigy, that would make them a keen observer of their surroundings, and that's a precious resource when you're telling stories. They have a really smart observer who can pick up on details.
Right.
And so that was how I began the experiment of making him mute in the story. And of course, as you write, you make lots of experiments, and they get tested, and some of them don't work, and they don't. No one ever knows that you made that experiment because it's not in the final form. This was one of those things that dovetailed again and again with other interests in the story. And so it sort of reinforced, and it became more and more central to his character that he lacked the power of speech.
We're talking to David Robleski, author of the best-selling novel, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. You start the book with a quotation from Charles Darwin, and I was thinking a lot about that in terms of the continuity among species. Dogs and people and all sorts of other species can love and suffer, and they can sulk and, you know, be scared and depressed, and they can be joyous. But in this book, so you're drawing on Shakespeare and Hamlet in particular, it seems to me that only human beings are capable of tragedy. And I wanted to know if you thought that was true.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It depends, I guess, on how you define tragedy. But, I mean, I think of tragedy as a literary form that is an investigation into how we process our own mortality, how we deal with that. I don't know of any. I'm kind of a junkie for research into animal cognition and so on. I'm just trying to think whether I've read of any research that bears on this question. And I don't know that we know whether animals are aware of their own mortality.
Right. It's something that I think about because there's the making the grand separation between human beings and animals. There's some truth to that, but the more you look at animals and study them, and the more common ground you find. So it's just, I don't know, it's a question that
I do absolutely agree that we divide the world on this false species boundary that says there's human beings and there's everyone else. And of course, that's the last 20 years of research into animal behavior, animal cognition has just every couple of months another paper or result comes out that says no, this dividing line that we thought was there is not there. Animals have the same machinery for processing emotion that we have, and so the wall keeps coming down a little further. So I think that at some level, the sense of the emotional basis for tragedy is there in many animals, certainly in dogs that have this very complex emotional life. But what that experience is exactly like, it's one of those things I think we'll be wondering about for a long time.
Right. So this book, it has a character that is totally outside of the feeling of the book is totally outside the digital age. It's a book that sometimes when I'm reading a book or mystery, you think, oh, this could be a film. But I was reading this book and thinking, this could not be a film. And if it did, it would be it'd be a completely different thing. It would lose a great deal. It's a long book. It invites being savored and read slowly for just pleasure in the written word. And I wondered, when you were writing it, did you seclude yourself away from kind of 21st century accoutrements and pace of life and so on?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's exactly the experience I want you to have. I think of it as a very old-fashioned kind of story that is meant to be read slowly and is meant to be an immersive experience. So that's true.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's set in 1972 mainly or earlier, and so it is really a pre-digital age story. But I was not secluded in the way that you suggest. Most of the time that I was writing this book, I was working. My day job was as a software developer, and so I was immersed in the digital world and have been for close to 30 years. So it was really an imaginative exercise on my part, drawing from my childhood, which was growing up on a small farm in central Wisconsin.
At some point when you were younger, you studied theater and I guess wanted to be an actor for a bit. And I've often thought that there's an element of acting in fiction writing, and that you have to totally embody a character that is truly not you, the author or the actor. Do you feel that there's a connection of that kind?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, one way that I think about this book very often is that it is a it's a play. I mean, it has five act structure. There are five parts of the story, and in fact, even just thinking of it as structured in five acts was one of the events that got me from imagining writing a novel to getting started writing on it. So it absolutely is an exercise in embodying another character. What's great about it is that it, for people like me who have no acting ability at all, which I discovered very early on, is that you can revise it and draft it, and it doesn't happen to it doesn't have to happen in real time. It's not a performance in that way, which is an entirely different set of skills that are certainly beyond me, but I admire them very much in other people, of course.
This was, I think, your first novel. It's very long. It's 562 pages. As you said, it's in five parts. What were the challenges for you in managing such a big project?
Part of the challenge is just keeping everything in my head at once. There comes a time, depending on where you are in the making of a novel, when you're writing the first draft, your goal and the challenge is to just figure out what happens and get to the end of that draft and have some cobbled together form of a story so you know what you're dealing with. But after that, while you're doing revision, the problem increasingly becomes holding the entire thing in your mind at once, so that when you're revising one section, you understand that it's going to have an effect somewhere else, because the better put together a novel is, the more tightly things interact. And so you're constantly going through the process of sort of tightening down all the nuts and bolts until any change here has ramifications all over the place. And
right.
that's where if there's any point where you really need to seclude yourself, for me, that's where it was, because, the phone ringing or the answering email can just erase all that stuff from your head. And there's not, for me at least, there wasn't a lot of extra space once I got the whole novel in my mind at once.
When you finish something like this and it goes to the publisher, it's printed, it's a successful novel, that's a real change in your life. Have you put a new novel in to fill the void, so to speak?
Well, a lot of the last year for me has been spent doing book touring and talking to groups at bookstores, like I'll be doing tonight and so on. I am starting on a new novel, but it's very hard for me to do first draft work when I'm traveling.
Right.
For some reason, first draft for me is something that happens in my very boring office at home, all white walls, nothing interesting to look at. Revision, second draft and beyond, I actually prefer to do outside of my office. So when I'm home, I'm working on that book. When I'm traveling, I'm generally doing research, and so it's taken a little longer to get started than I'd like, but it's the best problem in the world to have.
David Robleski is author of the novel The Story of Edgar Sawtell, and he will be at Collected Work Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. And once again, part of the proceeds from the book sales will go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
And we'll see you tonight. We're going to have a little tiny break right now, and Robert Knott is standing by. We'll be right back.